In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
South Dakotans will decide on 7 ballot questions in November. We better start figuring them out. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, July 31st. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, an overview of the 4 constitutional amendments, 2 initiated measures, and 1 referred law that voters will consider this fall. Dakota political junkies Tom Dempster and Jonathan Ellis join us to talk about abortion, open primaries, recreational marijuana, sales tax on consumables, Medicaid work requirements, and that carbon pipeline legislation. But first, more from our conversation with U.S. Senator Mike Rounds. We'll talk tariffs, energy, and rulemaking. Plus, we will preview the annual Sioux River Folk Festival. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. When we talk about inflation and the U.S. economy, the picture includes a recent leveling off of prices. Meanwhile, wages are up, rents are down, paychecks, they're going farther. So why does it feel like prices are so high? Consider this. The 1.1% increase in grocery prices over the past 12 months comes on the tail of a 4.7% increase the year before, and a 12.2% increase the year before that. Now, let's throw in some politics. How much does what an American president or American presidential candidate says influence inflation? How much is determined by other factors, like a pandemic? I spoke with U.S. Senator Mike Rounds about how he holds presidents accountable for their words and their actions. This is the second part of a conversation we began earlier in the week. We'll also talk about his thoughts on a recent landmark U.S. Supreme Court ruling, one that drastically changes the system of checks and balances in the American government.
Coming out of the pandemic, there was a demand once again by consumers, and there was a demand right now as the economy started to turn on again. We needed those supply chains to get put back in as quickly as possible, and they just simply didn't. But when they did, and when energy was being driven up in price, it impacted the supply of everything else. And so there really is a point at which we could see where inflation was lower coming through the pandemic. And what happened on day one, as I say, when the president said very clearly to investors, don't invest in traditional energy sources because I can shut that down with a stroke of a pen. Mm-hmm. And I really do feel that that made a major change in what inflation did at that point. Now, inflation would have changed somewhat based upon an insatiable demand as we came out of the pandemic. But I think it was really impacted heavily by the failure to recognize that the supply side had to catch up during that time period. And the administration just didn't do that.
I have talked to farmers who are very enthusiastic about a future Trump presidency. They want to vote for Donald Trump, but they're also incredibly concerned about a proposed 60% tariff on China, 10% tariff on imports, what that does to prices, just as you know, families who make purchases. And then also they remember how they suffered during the trade war with China from the previous Trump administration. So specifically, when you look at Donald Trump's tariff proposals, what do you think that might do to prices?
You know, I think part of it is how much of it will be talk and how much of it will be direct action. And I can't tell you what that's going to look like. Sometimes I think he's trying to be, the businessman again, threatening in terms of what he could do. Very similar to when he said that, you know, we could pull out of NATO. And what he really wanted was for everybody else to pull their own weight by increasing the amount of defense spending they did themselves. That did put NATO in a better position to respond to what's occurring in Ukraine because the other countries actually started to ante up in terms of the defense, and they didn't just rely on the United States. I don't know if he's that far along on his discussions right now in terms of what he wants out of China. I do know that China has become more than just a competitor with us right now. They are a near peer adversary, and they have a different look at what the rest of the world should look like. They have felt disrespected for 100 years. Xi Jinping now wants to gain back that what he considers respect. He believes that the South China Sea is his own bathtub to play in, and 60% of all the trade in the world goes through that area. And he wants to have an acknowledgement that China is responsible for and controls that trade. And that's something that the rest of the world, the rest of the civilized world, has said, no, we want free trade. We want, you know, freedom of the seas and the ability to work in those areas without having to recognize a Chinese dominance in that area. So I'm not exactly sure, and I have not spoken to him in some time with regard to what his policies would actually look like, how much of it is this is what we could do versus this is what we would actually do. But I think for a huge number of people back home, they are so concerned about what they've seen in this administration that they appreciated more seeing what the economy looked like under the previous administration than what it looks like under the Biden administration. And they're prepared to take the risk that a lot of what the president is suggesting is designed to be a positioning statement as opposed to an actual implementation. But time will tell. And, you know, most certainly this is something that those of us that work in Congress will have an opportunity to weigh in as well with regard to any tariffs or anything that we might support or which we might believe to be detrimental to our own home states.
Yeah. As a journalist, I find that hard. In the sense that if President Biden says, don't invest in pipelines, I want to take him seriously and report on that. If Donald Trump says, I'm going to do 60% tariffs, I'm expected to say, well, does he really mean that or is he positioning? It seems like there's two standards, and one is for Donald Trump because of the way he uses, you know, his rhetoric. How do you sort through that?
Well, I think part of it is because with President Biden, he actually killed the project. He didn't just suggest he would kill a project. He actually killed that pipeline, and that was a $2 billion project that went nowhere, with significant investors feeling a real loss on traditional energy sources. On the other side of it, President Trump said to NATO, you know, look, very clearly, you know, it's something that we could drop out of, we could, but he never did it, but he said it. And in doing so, he got some results. So I just look at each of the two men in terms of what they've actually done versus what their results were. And, yeah, I get the reason why we say, you know, well, you know, how much of what President Trump has said he's going to do will he actually do?
Yeah.
He starts out as a negotiation to begin with. And sometimes that's different in politics. It's not what most folks that are in public office do because most of us want to be stable in terms of, you know, we want to be recognized as being consistent in the messaging. President Trump's messaging appears to be one of, look, we're going to make America first on this stuff, and we're going to do whatever we can to protect American industries, and we're going to bring back a lot of that industry into the United States, which sounds really, really good. But what we want to make sure is that we have supply chains that work with our allies, and China lately has not been an ally. Now, a lot of us would like to get back to the point of being a good trading partner with China, but they've got to make some changes first. And part of it is they've got to change the rhetoric which out there right now, which says basically that, you know, they want more of a Chinese culture in regard to a lot of the ownership interest with regards to proprietary items on intellectual properties and so forth as well. And the best example I can give you on China, I had a chance to visit with their ambassador several years ago, and I explained that I was really frustrated with the fact that so many of the things that we had done with China ended up with China stealing proprietary items of intellectual properties, copyrights, patents, and so forth, and that they ignored the ownership of those things. And the Chinese ambassador explained it this way. He said, you have to understand that our culture is 5,000 years old. And he says, we still struggle with understanding how a person can own an idea. And that makes sense to me in terms of why there appears to be this acceptance to being able to ignore copyrights and ignore patents. But that's what has, in many cases, made America the country that it is, because we've respected and encouraged new ideas and new development where entrepreneurs can make a profit and keep that profit based upon ingenuity because it's protected by copyrights and patents. But in China, they, if they reject that, it makes it difficult for someone to be successful in actually having these ideas if they can't simply have them be protected. And so, you know, those are the types of things that I think we need to talk about, dialogue with China, and hopefully come back to a more agreeable relationship with them in the future. But, you know, it's going to take some time to get that done.
If Donald Trump becomes president, we've got plenty of time to talk about this because the election isn't until November, of course. But I'm just curious, then, is it Congress's responsibility to, you know, to parse those things out? Is it voters' responsibility to pay attention? You know, if this candidate says something, I'm really trying to, you know, sincerely get my mind around the fact that we're supposed to vote for a president who's a person, not a party or a platform. And if we can't understand what he says he's going to do and what he means and what he doesn't mean, then who is the person that's accountable for that? Is that Congress in your mind? Is that you?
I think in a lot of ways, once you have a president, they become a branch of the government, but there are checks and balances. The challenge will be, will those checks and balances be able to work? I think the Supreme Court actually did a really good thing most recently with regard to Chevron. And the elimination of Chevron as a document that basically said that you had to give an extra special amount of deference to a federal agency that was making rules based on an ambiguous law. And I think it did a couple things. Number one, it brought the courts back in saying, no, we're the decision makers if there's ambiguity in a law as to what they meant. But the other piece of this is it will force Congress to do a better job of writing more specific legislation rather than ambiguous laws, kind of in a hopeful way of saying, you know, we're going to write this so that agencies can be very broad in their rulemaking. I think that change is going to make more accountability for Congress, and it's going to take the final decision and put it back into the courts rather than into a bureaucrat's hands. And one more item, I think it will also provide an opportunity for a regulatory agency to be more in communication with a legislative body that actually passes a law, similar to what happens in 41 states where we have a rules review process that we don't have in Congress today. And that would allow for rules to be put in, but with more consultation with Congress, even if it's on an informal basis, to make sure that the rules as they're being implemented actually follow what is the spirit of the law that was passed by Congress. So you're going to see some real significant changes, in my opinion, significant changes in the way the rulemaking occurs at the federal level. And that, I believe, will be a positive thing for the country overall. We'll have some short-term challenges, but long-term, I really think it's the right thing to do. And it'll bring some confidence for the first time in decades that accountability lies with people that are elected rather than unelected bureaucrats. And that would be a good thing.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. When South Dakotans cast their ballots in November, they will make their voices heard on 7 state ballot questions. Our Dakota political junkies are here to walk through those questions. What a yes or no would mean for the state. We're just getting started with a preview. Of course, every journalistic organization in the state is going to do a deep dive into all of these, but let's get started. Jonathan Ellis is co-founder of the Dakota Scout. Tom Dempster is a former South Dakota State Senator, and they are seated around the table from me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio. Senator Dempster, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Glory, I'm absolutely delighted to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Editor Ellis, thank you for being here as well.
Hey, anytime there's a ballot issue party, I want to be invited.
All right. So 7 questions, which harkens back to the beach towel ballot of 2016, which had 10 questions, including initiated Measure 22, which was expansive ethics reform legislation. And there were a lot of questions about how much can go on the ballot. How easy is it to get something on the ballot?
Impossible.
There was a whole task force set to study this. And so here we are with 7 questions, which is not as long, but still, Jonathan Ellis, important.
Yeah, and one of the seven is actually from the legislature. So six of these are, one of them is, of course,
Are
two of them? Okay.
The gender-neutral language
for
the governor and Medicaid work requirements.
I forget that. Yes, that's correct. And then, so two of them are, and then we have one that's referred by voters. Voters have had that power since 1898, and so they can take a law that the legislature passes and then say, hey, we want to weigh in on this.
Mm-hmm. And that's a potential repeal of Senate Bill 201, which is that carbon pipeline, really hard-fought but controversial legislation. So we'll talk about that in a moment. So four constitutional amendments, three initiated measures, one of which is a referred law.
Yep.
Everybody still with us? Yeah. Start throwing more numbers at you. So let's start with those amendments.
Let me step back for just a minute.
Good idea.
Is it a good idea?
It
Are
is.
You sure about that?
Well, keep going. I'll let you know.
for me, this is the election this year. The presidential election in South Dakota is all but a foregone conclusion. There's no governor's race. There's no Senate race. I'm going to suggest that maybe the U.S. House race is all but a foregone conclusion. Probably, but what's really important are these constitutional and these initiated measures. These measures are the election in November. And the consequences of these measures are absolutely extraordinary.
All right. Deep breath. So it's time to start learning about what we should do. Abortion, Jonathan, is a constitutional amendment. One side is calling it the abortion amendment. The other side is calling it the freedom amendment. Seven states, I think, have voted on abortion in one way or the other since Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022. Six states, including South Dakota, will be weighing in on some kind of abortion legislation this year. Where do you want to begin with what the controversies are of this, or what the opportunities are, what is sort of the political landscape, I guess, of this abortion amendment that you think is relevant?
Well, you reference other states that have weighed in on this, including some red states, and all of them have voted to either expand or maintain abortion rights. And I think if you would have told people who were pro-choice prior to Roe v. Wade being overturned that this would be that it would actually be better for abortion rights state by state, they'd be surprised. But this is what's happening, and I suspect, given the history of votes in this state, we're likely to see that outcome here as well. And if it does if it does succeed here, it will loosen restrictions on abortion much more than what existed prior to the trigger law going into place in 2022 when Roe v. Wade was overturned and immediately.
How so? Because that's not what the proponents say. They say no, it's going to be exactly what we had under Roe v. Wade.
No, there were some pretty strict measurements and measures and regulations that had been in place that the legislature had enacted again over the years trying to get as close as they could to restricting the abortion. Well, those go away. I mean, they went away when the trigger law went into effect. But if abortion comes back, those regulations would not be in place. And so, they try to say it's just bringing back Roe v. Wade. Well, within the context of Supreme Court decisions over the years, you know, legislatures did have the authority
to waiting periods,
mandatory doctor consults.
This is the language you have to use. But those things could come back in the future. Lawmakers could. If this amendment passes, Tom, maybe this is a good time for you to jump in. Lawmakers could turn around to, well, it's a constitutional amendment.
It's a constitutional amendment.
So it helps us understand what lawmakers, what power would they have after this is passed to say enact a waiting period or your doctor must say this to you.
Oh, you could probably dance around some of the constitutional measures, but that's pretty difficult to do, and most people don't. That's extremely difficult to do.
They might not want to, depending on what the voters say and how many of them say it. What would be the political?
Well, let's remember that this isn't the first time that the people have voted on this or referred this. This isn't the second time that people have referred this. This is the third time The first time they overturned the legislature, the second time they overturned the legislature, and I would guess this third and let's hopefully final time they will overturn the legislature again. What is it, some 65-67% of Democrats support this bill, some 55-60% of independents support the bill. Even Republicans, I think it's some 45% of Republicans support the bill as opposed to 30% of Republicans who oppose the bill. Most people, in my opinion, most people, we've vetted this issue for a long, long time. Most people already know how they're going to vote on this bill.
Interesting.
Or on this constitutional amendment.
On this constitutional amendment. All right. Medicaid work requirement. This is a Senate joint resolution that, so voters passed Medicaid expansion in 2022.
Yep.
And it was enacted. And now the lawmakers are saying, hey, let's put in the Constitution that we can put, that the lawmakers are allowed to put in work requirements. Do I understand that correctly?
You do. And by my take, the two extremely talented legislators, Majority Leader Casey Crabtree and Tony Von Hyzen over in the House sponsored this joint resolution. I believe that only the state of Georgia has a work requirement that would make South Dakota the second state that would do that. I'm not certain of the impact because there's all sorts of provisions within the federal statutes. I think it's more of a statement of intent than it is a statement of purpose.
Right.
It would allow waivers if the event comes up that, you know, you could seek a waiver. And I will say that this is Wisconsin voters approved something very similar to that, and it was very widely popular. Now, I would expect that the health lobby, which is pretty powerful in this, will mount a pretty vigorous campaign against that.
Sure.
But on the face of it, most people are like, well, yeah, you should have to be able to work in order to get a government subsidy or whatever. And so, so they have to overcome that mentality. And again, I think it polls fairly popular with voters in other states. I can't see why it wouldn't necessarily
How
be
does
popular
the fact that voters were fairly educated about this in 2022 about Medicaid expansion, it reminds me a little bit of minimum wage, where, you know, voters said, we want this. Lawmakers said, well, not for kids under a certain age. Mm-hmm, and voters referred that and said, no, we told you to do this with the minimum wage. This kind of feels familiar to me. It's like, well, we told you to expand Medicaid. Could you see voters saying that?
I would say this. You don't, the voters don't have an option as a ballot issue goes through saying, hey, let's amend it so it says this. And
right.
There's not a process that plays out in the legislature the way you fix things during the process. And so this is sort of a natural extension of maybe voters saying, yeah, well, we gave it an all or nothing here 1 year, but there are some fixes we would want to do later. I mean, so I think it's a legitimate process.
Yeah. One more amendment we'll quickly touch on, which is this changing of the he and him pronouns in the state constitution to the governor, basically because we have a female governor now, and lawmakers referred this to in a joint resolution. To say it should say the governor may do this, the governor may do that, the lieutenant governor may do that, instead of he may or he may. This seems like a fairly easy constitutional amendment. Lots
it
of states are attempting here looking
is,
at their language.
It is. Vote yes and look deeper and look deeper into the other measures that really require your attention
and
focus.
Right. How about some initiated measures? Let's go back to well, let's start with marijuana. Recreational marijuana, which has quite a history. This is another one, Tom, where this is the third time that voters are going to come forward and have something to say on this in recent memory, but yet it hasn't always been consistent. Sometimes voters have said yes, sometimes voters have said no, sometimes something was unconstitutional. We'll dive into that all when we have more time. But what do you see in the initiated measure 29, which is a legalization of recreational marijuana?
Well, one of the things that always surprised me, can you believe that I ever had any political opponents on any of my bills? One of the things that really surprised me is those political opponents or those political fights never go away. Mm. You might propose a bill, or you might defeat a bill. Just within 2 or 3 seconds, another bill is going to resurface that's going to be exactly the same issue. And the same thing is true in marijuana. This is a fight. It's always been a fight. Many business groups oppose it because of insurance ramifications on their employees. It's very complicated. This is the way we sort things out.
Yeah. Jonathan, where should we start with this? And we'll take some time on this initiated measure.
Well, as you point out, this is the third time. It's kind of interesting because Tom pointed out that this was the third time on abortion, and this would actually be the third time on a grocery tax, too. The supporters of this measure, obviously, they won in 2020, but then lost with the Supreme Court on the single subject issue, and then lost again, and they think that the electorate will be similar to what it was in 2020. It's interesting that it's a very just like, hey, it's going to be the initiative measure is very simple. That it's just going to be legalized, and it basically throws it to the legislature. Okay, voters weighed in. Now it's up to you to regulate this and like give them really kind of a wide avenue to set the parameters if in fact voters approve this. So that's unlike, for example, the 2020 ballot, which was very specific about how cannabis, medical cannabis, hemp, how all of that would be introduced and regulated. So this is very
2018.
Different.
I think Amendment A, 2018, which had both of them together, and IM-26, legalizing medical.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, maybe it was overturned by 2020. Is that the? I'm getting my.
I'm gonna look it up. I'm gonna flip through my papers. You keep.
Okay.
While you're flipping through papers, can we talk about open primaries? Do we get to change the subject, or do you want to stay? Do you want to stay on marijuana?
When I find it, because this is okay. In 2020. In 2020, South Dakota voters approved Constitutional Amendment A by a vote of 54-45 to legalize recreational marijuana. So see how I wrote down 2018, and it was 2020. So we're just fact-checking this stuff on the air.
2020. Yep, this is journalism in process.
Got to look at the stack of notes.
It's simple. Just vote yes or no. Right?
Right.
Why are we here then, Tom?
No. Exactly right.
But that was, so in 2020, as I understand it or remember it, they were tied together, right?
There were basically
this
three
big,
major
long,
issues,
right?
Yeah.
And that's when it was said that it was a violation of the single issue
Correct.
Rule.
Yeah.
And that's why it failed. And then legalized
that's
marijuana.
That's why it was overturned.
That's why it was overturned.
Right.
And then legalized marijuana for medical marijuana came into
right.
play, and now this is just recreational marijuana, but
yep.
that failed in 2022.
Yes, the recreation. So there were
by
separate
40s,
proposals
yeah,
in 2020.
53-47. Yeah.
Yeah, there were separate proposals in 2020, and one of them was a separate medical, and then Amendment A had all of them lumped
yeah.
in together.
Yeah.
And so both of those passed, and
right.
it was Amendment A that got struck down.
Struck down. All right. So do you see a different electorate in 2024? Is it going to fail again? What's different now? And I want to go back to maybe what you were saying about who shows up in a presidential race versus 2022, but in South Dakota, that's less consequential because we largely know how red the state is.
Yeah.
So you have to get voters to the poll, but normally you would get more of them during a presidential election.
Yeah, I mean, my guess this time, it fails. Just my guess.
What do you think?
If I were going to bet on it, I would probably bet on it failing as well. I still think it probably has a better chance than it did 2 years ago because the electorate will be a little bit different.
Yeah.
Presidential races tend to, even though as Senator Dempster says it's a foregone conclusion, they tend to bring out voters.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. So it might be a little bit of a different element than it was in 2022 in 2022 you had some, bigger races, statewide races as well that don't
right.
exist here. So...
And they also have this language in here that says businesses can still go back to that insurance
mm-hmm.
question you had. And this is the measure will not require employers to permit or accommodate employees engage in the conduct allowed in the measure. So I'm reading that as saying that the private employer can still say, you can't do that and work for me. Does that address the question that you think
I don't know.
Some business leaders had before?
Know.
We don't know.
I don't know if that's legal, to be honest with you.
Sure.
I mean, my wife's a lawyer and has had to research this issue, and I think there's some open
right.
open issues there about whether that can actually happen.
Right. All right. So that's, like I said, we're doing a quick overview today of all of these, and then people will be, diving deep into them, which brings us to the open primaries, which we're going back to the amendment. So an open primary amendment, that's Amendment H, which is a top two primary.
Right. Full,
explain it.
Full disclosure. Yes. I'm part of the group that has initiated this measure. Mm-hmm. And all we're saying is that there are 150,000 people, independents, that are not able to vote in the most important election in the state of South Dakota, and that's the Republican primary. I think it's somewhere between a half to two-thirds of our legislature is already elected through the primary system. And we think it's fundamentally unfair that 150,000 independents are excluded from that Republican primary. And if there is such a thing as party bosses in South Dakota, we also think that people don't like the fact that Republicans, the head of the Republican Party has said we oppose, head of the Democrat Party has said we oppose. That's probably what you would expect because parties want to preserve their capacity to have that guaranteed spot on the general election. We think parties should have to work for that spot. We think candidates should have to work for that spot. Makes for a much more competitive, much broader top two primary system that I think people will say is fair and absolutely necessary.
Explain this part of it where the candidate selects the name of the political party to be listed next to their name on the primary candidate. The party designated by the candidate does not imply an endorsement of the candidate by that
party.
Sure. Is that a change?
No. Well, it is a change because this failed the last time it was up. And the reason it failed is because the initiative said that there won't be any party labels on candidates at all. Okay. That's a bridge too far. Now this has been reconstructed or rebuilt to say, well, of course, state your party affiliation. And that only makes sense to me.
Jonathan, anything you want to add in how you're seeing this play out? The first thing I would say, you know, is that I'm watching the Olympics and I'm seeing a lot of ads for this one already.
Oh, good. I'm delighted to hear you say that.
The first political ad that I've seen in South Dakota has been this ad on the Olympics that says, you know, the best, all these athletes are playing, but these...
Top two means the best two.
Right.
Thank you for letting me...
They've done a very, early entry into the Olympic audience is watching and they're making association with this.
Smart.
Which I thought was smart, effective campaigning as well. But what else are you hearing from people who may be opposed to it?
Well, I mean, Tom obviously gives his side of it, and I think it's fair for us to say that there's another side of this, I'm not an advocate for that side, but we should present it, shouldn't we? Mm-hmm. Just that, you know, the political parties they're private organizations, and they should be allowed to set the rules for selecting their own candidates, rather than, you know, a broader electorate who has no stake in, for example, in a Republican Party or in a Democratic Party, being allowed to voice, you know, how a private organization selects its candidates. Now, I think it's fair, though, for taxpayers to say, well, why should we pay for your nominating processes then? Why don't you guys pay for your nominating processes? I mean, so there are questions about that. But there is that alternative take that these are private organizations that deserve to have their own mechanisms for selecting their own candidates. When they say party bosses, let's be very clear that the Republican Party, being chairman of the Republican Party these days is one of the worst jobs you could probably have because trying to wrangle everybody together. I mean, it's not like they're dictating who the candidates are. So, you know, I think it is a voting reform that a lot of other states have probably taken. Mm-hmm. And I think that the advocates of that have made a pretty compelling case that South Dakota is an outlier in some sense of how we actually conduct primaries.
I'm not sure. Is that true?
That is true.
Three states, California, Nebraska, and Washington use top tier. Alaska uses a top four.
There are other types of reform. There are other types of ballot reforms, though, that have taken place in it.
Say more about that. Sure, you probably know more about
Sure. Virtually all the states that surround South Dakota have a more open process than South Dakota does. Okay. We are the only state that restricts 150,000 people from the ballot. It just doesn't make sense. Okay. And it is. If I were an independent, and if I paid taxes, I would not be very happy about my incapacity to vote in a public election process.
Yeah, or you could just register with a party.
Oh, sure.
That's not hard.
That isn't hard.
And participate.
Yeah, and participate. So that means in order for me to vote in an election, what? I have to become something that I'm not?
We got time for one more in the last minute.
I'm an independent, by the way, so I don't get to vote.
So Jonathan and I are both, we're both independents.
Right. Well, you probably have to be, don't
I've
you?
Seen some yes. skinny ballots in my day, right. I'll tell you that one. But that does not say how I'm going to vote on your ballot question. I'm not revealing that, but yeah. I am telling you that I have seen some skinny ballots as a South Dakota independent.
Well, you just get to walk in the booth and walk out, nothing to it. Make a couple checks and then you're done.
I still go. I get my sticker. I fill in my one bubble.
Can we talk about sales tax?
Yes, we better do that. But we really have like a minute or so. So this, hit the high points, the sales tax. And then
this is one of the reasons why people don't like initiated measures, because when you've got a legislative process, you've got all the lobbyists, you've got all the people who are interested in the bill that pound you at a legislative hearing. And through that pounding process, bills get defeated. Bills pass, but through that pounding process, a bill starts as soft as clay, and by the time it's done, it really hardens into concrete, something that you can, something that actually makes sense. This bill, in my opinion, does not make sense. It's pure chaos.
Governor Kristi Noem wanted to repeal the food tax. Jonathan, does that play into the campaigning between now and then? The fact that she originally wanted this, did not get it. Lawmakers voted on a different tax reduction. To Tom's point, there are parts of this bill that people are criticizing how it would actually, show up in our lives and what it would do to, the funding of state government altogether. Does she play a factor in this going forward, or is she done with it?
I feel like she's probably done with this, and because it's not a repeal of sales tax on food, it's broader than that. And I would just say that Mike Rounds in 2004 was sort of the leader in defeating that measure then, and it lost by 68%. So if there's not a strong figurehead like that, maybe it's a different outcome this year. But I would think that this repeal effort has its work cut out for it.
Yeah, I still remember Dennis Dugard, when he was governor, in an interview pounding the table in front of me and saying, most people can perfectly afford to pay the tax on food.
Of leaving a $123 million hole in the state budget from now until forevermore. Maybe putting in jeopardy the $44 million of tobacco tax, and what is it, another $12 million of tobacco tax settlement.
By the way,
if this bill passes, how about cities and municipalities?
Well, they can still do their thing.
Oh, really?
Says, yes.
Says who?
Says the. Do I have to file through my piece of paper to find
there's,
that?
But there's
I don't
some
think
legal,
so.
And there's some. This is again the process of not. It doesn't continue to get played out in committee hearings, and so there are some legal issues.
There are some questions.
Potentially.
Has not been pounded into cement.
Not been forged in your opinion.
That political process is a wonderful,
tough process. In your analysis,
this process
has not been forged yet.
Thank you. Okay. In my perfect analysis, that has not been.
I don't know that I said perfect analysis, but all right, that is what the Dakota political junkies do. Jonathan Ellis, Dakota Scout, you can find that online, or you can find the print product around the state. Tom Dempster, former state lawmaker, welcome back next time. We're going to have a good run to November. Lots to talk about.
Thank you.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. It is time to pack up your lawn chair and head to Newton Hills State Park. The 2024 Sioux River Folk Festival is this weekend, August 2nd through the 4th. Janet Schmitz and Connor Peterson are co-presidents of the nonprofit South Dakota Friends of Traditional Music, and that's the organization that hosts the Folk Festival. And they're with me now in the Kirby Family Studio. Janet, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having us. Great to be here.
How about I turn on everybody's microphone? Janet, thanks for being here.
Here I am.
There I am.
Connor, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm very focused on the comfort of your headphones. And this is live radio. Let's talk for people. This is an institution. It's iconic, the FOTM and the Folk Festival. But there are always new people who do not understand the magic of this event and what happens at it. So from that perspective to those people, Janet, what is the Folk Festival?
Well, it's been going on for 44 years, so we must be doing something right to be around for that long, for sure. I think that there's only one festival in the state that is older than us by 1 year, and I think that's the Black Hills Bluegrass Festival that happened a couple years ago. But it is a three-day music event that happens the first weekend of August every year down in Newton Hills State Park. That's been the home for the Folk Fest for about 40 of the 44 years. This was the brainchild of Gaynor Johnson and Bill Peterson 44 years ago that wanted to put this Folk Fest together, and it initially was held in Chautauqua Park just outside of Canton, kind of on a floodplain down there. They built a stage. They had some problems with some flooding, and one year the stage literally floated away. And a friend of theirs who was the park manager at that time came to them and said, why don't you come to the park and have your festival here?
Yeah.
And we've been there ever since, and it's a great family event. I mean, there are people who literally have grown up coming to this festival, and now they are still coming and bringing their children, and it's, you know, family reunions that happen around that weekend. It's just, you know, I always feel that music at music festivals, you kind of find people at their best.
Yeah.
Because music is such an integral part of all of our lives in a million different ways.
Yeah.
And our mission is to preserve that traditional music aspect, folk music, bluegrass music, Americana music. But we, you know, we throw a little bit of, you know, variety in there too. We've had some that have been a little more on the bluesy side and countryside, and you know, so we like to mix it up a little bit. So I don't want people to get hung up on that word folk fest, because sure. It's so much more than that.
It is great music.
Yeah.
You're going to hear some great music.
Yep.
Are you related to Bill, Connor?
No relation there.
Okay. Little Peterson power in the house, but not necessarily from the same family.
Different spelling. Ours is the Norwegian way. I think his is the other one, with a T. Mine's
okay.
The D.
So tell me a little bit how you got into and really stepped into a leadership role, because you've been on the show before.
Yeah.
As a really great musician who's played,
So
you got some credits to your name.
It was 2013 was my first year of going. And I had just started playing with a bluegrass band, probably my first band that I'd ever been in. And they got a gig at the Folk Fest. And I showed up there we played on a Friday as an opening set. I got off work on Friday at 5, and I think the set started at like 6. So I had to haul down there, and I just ran up to the stage with my cello on my back, like huffing and puffing. And so that was my first kind of go in with that. We stayed up basically all night, Friday night, all night, Saturday night, jamming, and had a really great time. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to come back. So I think Greg Schmitz, who's the previous president, said, I'm going to get you on the stage every single year that I possibly can. And so I think I've basically played almost every year since 2013.
Yeah.
And it was probably 5 years ago, maybe 7, I can't remember, that I was asked to join the board. And then it was a couple years ago where I was asked to become president. So me and Janet have been working really well together, and really enjoy that aspect of kind of figuring out what it takes to run a festival and all the intricacies that go behind it that people don't actually see all the time. It's really interesting, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. What do you love about that homecoming, seeing people that you haven't seen? Because some people are going to come from all across the country, and they show up here once a year.
Yeah.
Are you too busy to really enjoy that, or is it like a, you know, campground homecoming for you too?
It's a little bit of both, because I've got a family of two kids and a wife. One is 9 months old, and my other is 3 and a half. So it's kind of trying to balance all my homies that are playing music and managing the festival, and also my family. So right.
It's kind of juggling with your family. Yeah.
It's juggling everything, but it's great fun though.
Well, yeah. Our producer, Ari Youngman, has all this great music queued up. So we're going to just pause and hear a little bit of some of the tunes.
Perfect.
This first one is Feed the Dog, a little bit of the song Bad Baby.
Words disguise as hope. I'm on the end of my road.
little bit of Feed the Dog. That's a Midwest-based four-piece band.
They're great.
I think it speaks to what you were saying about, you know, if you're thinking folk music and then you hear this, you
like
rethink of what your maybe your old definition.
They're kind of in that kind of jam grass genre, I think. And my brother Greg, that Connor mentioned a little earlier, he's just not happy if we don't have something just a little bit outside of the norm of what people might be thinking. Yeah. And so I think that'll kind of fulfill his wish of having that one act. And, you know, honestly, in past years when we've had those acts that are maybe a little bit different than what people might expect to hear, they end up being
the huge
hit of the weekend.
Yeah.
And they you know, people buy the merchandise. And, I mean, we have the bands comment every year, this is a merch buy-in crowd, and they are. They will buy the T-shirts and the CDs and the vinyl and everything. And the bands love coming to this festival, and we love getting that feedback from them, too.
Yeah, and so those guys are closing out Saturday night.
Okay.
So it's going to be really awesome.
Big crowd for that. All right, Megan and the Bird Watcher, take a little bit of a listen here. Listening to In the Moment on SDPB, and we're previewing just a couple artists from the upcoming Sioux River Folk Festival. It's at Newton Hill State Park, August 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. I guess I didn't check the pronouncer. Is it Megan?
Megan.
Okay. Megan and the Bird Watcher, M-A-Y-G-E-N. If you want to do some preview listening before the actual festival, what do you like about this group?
Yeah, they got a great sound. It's kind of the definitely like the folksy vibe, but with a little bit of a country twinge to it, and really great harmonies too. I just really, really enjoy them. I got to catch them actually at the Blue Ox Festival a couple weeks back. I guess more like a month back.
Yeah.
But yeah, super awesome, super awesome group. Really looking forward to them.
We're gonna close the show with some music from Brennan Lee. But before we do that, anything that people need to know about how to go, how to be a good festival goer, how to have a good time, pro insider tips.
Absolutely.
30 seconds. Yeah.
Bring your lawn chairs, bring your coolers. We do have a few food trucks, but you're welcome to bring your own food. You can bring whatever beverage you would like to put in that cooler with you. We have shade trees. We have lanterns and lights in the trees that we light up. You know, bring your family and plan to spend the day with us and just soak it all in.
Yeah, I love that. Anything else, Connor, you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, it's at Newton Hill State Park, so you're not only limited to just the music. You can go hiking. You can go hang out with people in the campsite. So about a lot of different stuff to do.
High Horse is going to be here on Friday. They're going to play live for us, also coming to the Sioux River Folk Festival. So you'll hear a little bit more of a preview in the first before the week is out. But shall we close with a little bit of Brennan?
Absolutely.
That'd be great.
Yeah, anything you want to say about...
Honestly, this will be my first exposure to Brennan Lee, and I've pulled her up on YouTube a little bit, and I can't wait to see what she brings to the festival.
I mean, she's from Nashville, so
there you go.
It's only good things.
That's our show for you today. We hope that it served you from all of us at SDPB. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, Lori.
Thanks.
You leave Mobile.